Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. When it comes to the marital I do's, men don't when their wives are spending more time in sickness than in health. And House of Cards has a public health message that's huge. No, it's not about using Purell to counter all the flesh that the Underwoods press. Joining us on the line to talk through these and other health issues is Art Kaplan. Art is head of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU's Langone Medical Center. He's also the co-host of the Everyday Ethics podcast. Hello, Art Kaplan.
Hello, hello. By the way, there isn't enough Purell in the world to cover all the flesh that the Underwoods press.
We'll get to them. So glad you're into it.
There are some great scenes along those lines, if you like that kind of thing, Art Kaplan. But let's start with something that's happening up in Vermont. I find this amazing, and I'm dying to get your take on this. This bill has been filed in Vermont, which would basically say, unless you opt out specifically of organ donation, we're going to presume we can have your organs after you die. I mean, wow, that's really something. I know there's an organ donation shortage, Art, but is this the way to address it?
You know, I think it is. I'll surprise you. I first of all, let's say there's really a shortage. We've got about, probably 90,000 people waiting for various organs. Most of them are going to die because there isn't one from a cadaver source. There are some people who get kidneys from living donors, but in general, we've got to find a way to get more organs from those who die. So polls show that most people want to be organ donors. There's pretty good donor signing rates at motor vehicles and going into registries. You know, they don't want to do it. But if you will, the default is you have to opt in. You have to say, I want to do this, even if you signed a card. I think it's just as respectful of informed consent if you say you have to opt out. It's not any different. You still need a consent. In this case, it's just a veto as opposed to a, yeah, I choose to do that. And obviously, you need to take it seriously. You'd have to have a registry of people who said no. You'd have to listen to the family if they said no. You could carry a card and say no. But I'm not sure it makes it any less consensual if you flip around the presumption.
You know, Art, you said something that I found pretty shocking, not your position on this, even though I'm surprised. You said a majority of people indicate that they do want to donate their organs. I find that amazing.
Yeah, you know, polls show support. I mean, probably 70, 80% support for organ donation.
Meaning their own organs or organ donations as a concept?
Well, it's funny here. When you ask people, do you want to donate your organs? Probably 70%. Do you think that Jim Browdy should donate his organs? Probably 80%.
So while he's alive.
It is a little higher.
Exactly.
a little higher for others than it is yourself, but still high. The problem is this. To be an organ donor, even if we all sign our driver's licenses and all support it, you have to die on life support. You have to have a head injury and everything else has to be in pretty good shape and you can't have any infectious diseases. It's hard to be an organ donor. You have to die in some very unusual circumstances. So even if, 100 people sign cards, the actual yield of organ donors out of that group is probably 2 to 3. And you can donate tissues like cornea without being on life support. But to get hearts and livers and kidneys, you need this sort of odd modes of death, and you have to be on the machines. So you really need big numbers to get organ donors.
I guess the thing that bothers me about this, Art, is not the concept of organ donors. I think, as you say, most people think it's a good thing, and certainly there are people on these endless waiting lists for organs. It's that a lot of people just don't pay attention. So I can just envision this scenario where, you know, Johnny dies, and Johnny's family, you know, has no idea that this is the deal, and you're having a fight over Johnny's organs in the hospital room. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So think of it this way, Marjorie. Let's say one of your relatives dies and you're there. It's not that I just come in and yank out the organs. I still have to come in and say, look, we presume that Johnny wanted to be an organ donor. Most people do. Do you have any reason to think he wouldn't want to? That's the conversation you're going to get.
Yeah.
As opposed to, Johnny has died, we're so sorry. Has he ever thought about organ donation?
Yeah.
Is that something you would consider? Which is a little harder. You know, think of it this way. This is part of the whole behavioral economics thing. You know, if you're going to have a lunch line, put the vegetables first, not last. Turns out people eat more of them if you put them first. Do you want your paycheck direct deposited? If you don't, you have to opt out of it. It used to be you had to opt into it. There's all kinds of defaults out there and nudges to get people to behave in certain ways. This is one of them. Not trying to take away your rights, but sort of just flipping where we start.
Okay, now, let's move on to what Jim really wants to talk
about.
Exactly.
Well, we never miss an opportunity to work House of Cards into the show. And here's a little soundbite. Mm-hmm. This is President Frank Underwood, Kevin Spacey, made his case to FEMA, Federal Emergency Management Director, why unemployment is a health crisis.
Unemployment doesn't constitute a natural disaster, Mr. President.
The Stafford Act gives me full authority to define an emergency.
But, sir, we've only got about $3 billion left in the disaster relief fund, and we're about to go into hurricane season.
So we use the $3 billion that's there, and if a hurricane hits, Congress replenishes the funds, just as they always do.
When it comes to a disaster, every hour counts, sir. If we're waiting around for Congress to
Mr. Silver, this is moving forward.
People could die, Mr. President.
People are dying because they don't have jobs. Slower than a flood or an earthquake, but dying just the same.
Oh, be still my heart. So the case is being made by some, and I have to say, I'm there, that joblessness is a public health emergency. Their argument goes, you know, leads to anxiety, depression, physical ailments. Where are you on this? I think it's novel, but great.
It's novel. I agree. Unemployment is linked up to poor health. You know, years ago when doctors went down on those freedom rides to Mississippi. Mm-hmm. One of the things they prescribed when they got there was food. People were just hungry, and they wrote prescriptions for food, which is a kind of analogous, you know, situation. Look, I appreciate the sentiment of unemployment as a public health emergency. It does cause that, but it's not an emergency. It's chronic. You need to do something about unemployment. So Frank's idea, you know, throw a couple billion into the unemployment pot would probably employ, I don't know, a few people, but not many. It's crucial that you have good housing. Housing is linked up to health. That's linked up to a job. It's crucial you have nutritious food. That's linked up to a job. So no doubt about it, Frank's thinking the right way on this, but his solution is to try and get the economy humming so everybody has a job. Probably not going to solve it by spending the FEMA money.
I love that you're calling him Frank repeatedly. That really does it for me, let me tell you.
Yeah, and hoping that it doesn't dawn on too many people that this is chronic, as you say, and not an emergency thing.
But wait a second.
He's unbelievable as a character.
But Art, didn't you tell us months ago that you agreed with one of the reasons, I may get all this wrong, but I'll say it anyway and you'll correct me. The guy whose nomination as Surgeon General was held up, I think in part was held up because he considered guns to be a public health issue.
Yep.
Am I not right about that? So that's a chronic problem too. So if that's a public health issue, even though it's chronic, why is joblessness, unemployment, even though it's a chronic problem?
Well, the gun thing is safety and preventing
injury.
Okay. So there you got something, you know, that's really medical you can do. Getting people jobs, even if you just threw the FEMA funding at them or whatever. I'm not saying it's bad as a publicity stunt because it does remind people that unemployment is crucial if you're trying to do something about poor health. But at the end of the day, unemployment is crucial to just about everything, right? It's crucial to your long-term security and your retirement. It's crucial to being able to get your kids good education. Employment is just a pivotal factor. So I wouldn't call it – I don't want to make everything into a public health problem. It doesn't require any medical expertise. It requires some political expertise to get people jobs.
One last thing on this. You know, we often talk to guests in different contexts about how things that happen in the media, in movies, in television shows – trickle down to change perceptions. You know, Archie Bunker, Modern Family, those sort of things. Does a message like this, when a subset of America is really consumed with House of Cards, does it have any impact on public thinking about the joblessness issue, even if the public health emergency part of it is inappropriate?
Yeah, a tiny bit. I mean, sadly, you know, in the sort of heavily stratified world of TV viewing, media viewing, I don't know that House of Cards hits that many eyeballs. It gets chatter on the internet. That's good. A little bit, I would say. A little bit. It's not a major mover, but it's a little bit.
It's a major mover with me, I want you to know, Art Kaplan.
We're talking with Art Kaplan, our medical ethicist. Art, this next story I just get such a kick out of. It was initially reported in this study, one of the lead investigators from the Iowa State University. But anyway, the point of it is that in sickness and health, a wife's serious illness increases the chances of divorce later in life. husband not so much. And the piece does point out that, you know, we don't know which partner indicated the breakup. But, of course, a lot of women are chuckling over this because, you know, the idea is that that men really want somebody to take care of them. And if the wife is incapacitated and can't take care of him anymore – of course, you and Jim are not in this category. You know that, Art. But,
no.
But what use is she? What good is she? So it doesn't really surprise me at all. What do you make of it?
Who paid for that study? That is a ridiculously unnecessary study. Everybody knows that men are wusses. Everybody knows that men are jerks. Women are nicer. They're more caring. They rise to crisis better. I wouldn't even argue it. I'm not here to try and carry the men's team flag. I think men bailing in the face of, you know, I got to care for you or I've got a disabled child, which is another classic cause of divorce,
really?
By the way, with
it
a
is?
Mom hanging in there.
It is? I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Well, that is
if
really
you look
depressing.
At people who have had Down or autism or other kids with challenges, the dad often leaves. Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Wait, with controls where everything else being equal. It's the disability. That is really horrible to
hear.
Well,
you know, something that reminds me of a terrible case in Massachusetts where a mother was convicted of not giving
her. And by the way, let me correct something. I said the dad often leaves. I mean, among the divorces that happen, it's often the dad who
got it. Yeah, understood.
I was just going to say that I covered this trial in Massachusetts a few years back where a mother was convicted of not giving her autistic child the necessary treatments. The child had other issues. I believe mm-hmm. the child had cancer. And, you know, one of the things, and I felt this woman did a terrible thing, obviously, but she talked about how she overwhelmed she was. She was poor. She had no place to live. Her husband was long gone, and she was dealing with all this by herself. And wow. So, but it didn't occur to me at the time that was something.
Well, think of it this way: how many women are still in a marriage where they're getting abused because they're trying to take care of the kids?
That's a great point.
That's
phenomenal. That's right.
So the bottom line is, the men are the jerks.
I would not fund Iowa ever again for anything if they're wasting my time proving what is known. Men are jerks.
Hey, okay. We're talking Art Kaplan from NYU's Langone Medical Center. Art, we talked to you last week or week before about the training of doctors and other medical personnel and behavioral health things, that integration thing that's become a big mm-hmm. issue. Mm-hmm. There's a great piece, I think it was in the Washington Post, talking about a term I'd never heard before, which is called onco-talk. Training that doctors are getting to be more empathetic rather than just sympathetic to those who have cancer and are dying and that sort of thing. Could you explain to us what exactly it is?
Yeah. So basically, at some crude level, learning to listen. You don't necessarily have to interrupt the patient every 2 seconds. You can listen to them explain or say what it is they're feeling. Secondly, you don't have to solve every problem, but you want to listen to it and be supportive. Just to go back to the earlier topic, I think women do this better than men. I'm not sure women who make it to medical school do it better than men who make it to medical school. But in general, the idea is learn to listen. You don't have to solve it. Person complaining knows you can't necessarily fix everything, but you could lend an empathetic ear. You could try to hear out what their hopes and wishes are. You could try to engage with them in a way that I sometimes call it the little hope thing, and here's what I mean. People think, oh, you better not tell the truth about where somebody's going with a terrible disease. You don't want to take away their hope. But they kind of know if they have certain kinds of cancer from the internet or talking to other patients, or they pick it up from nurses or other doctors, that they don't have a lot of time. So what works better empathetically is you can say, hey, you know, I hope you make it to see the Super Bowl. Let's talk about that. That's coming in just a few days. Or, I hear you want to see the next episode of House of Cards. I'm going to watch that, too. Let's talk about that next week. So you're giving them little hope. It's more get empathetic to where their situation is. Don't ignore them, but don't overpromise.
Well, you know what I thought was so indicative of how grateful patients are was this patient herself when she got the kind of – when this doctor did sit down and listen to her, and she was suffering from cancer and she was going to be entering into hospice and there was not much time left, how this woman called him the best physician I've ever worked with because he talked with her or listened to her for 15 minutes, talk about, you know, weeping and saying she was exhausted and worried about the impact of her death on her two children because she was not that old. She was only in her 50s. It's amazing, really, how the little, just a little empathy or listening from a physician can turn the patient completely around.
Yeah, and, you know, the other challenge is, well, two, these days, one, physicians don't have time. They're really pushed to churn patients through in a lot of situations. So if we're going to have them listen, we may need to make sure that we give them the time to do it. And the other is, it's great that we have all the electronic health records in our computers, but I don't know about you, but when I go to the doctor, my doctor's not looking at me. He's looking at a screen.
Computer.
And typing in information. Yep. Sometimes turns toward me, but not that often. Now, since I love listening to myself talk, I don't care so much. But others would probably want a doctor paying attention to them.
You know,
would you interact with me a little more?
You know, my reaction to this story is analogous to your reaction to Iowa State spending money on this. Why are they spending money on research that we all knew about before they did their work? It is amazing. And I understand the burdens. I understand the shortages. I understand the multitude of things that people in the medical field have to do. This is so obvious to me that it is pathetic, and that in 2015, we have to tell people that if you listen in the medical field, if you listen to people in extremis or whatever that expression is, extremis, that it's going to help their state of mind and maybe even their physical self. Was that not obvious when you got into the field?
It is obvious, I have to say. I just think what's happened is the technology has started to overwhelm the time of people. They just have to realize that for a lot of folks, they just want that attentive ear, and venting makes them feel good, and it also builds trust, I might add, between you and the doc. But we don't tend to teach it. We tend to say, here's your creatinine output, or look at this image. You can see here that the tumor is moving in this direction. We tend to be pretty technocratic these days.
You know, this is a related to this, although not closely, but back, you know, 20 years ago when I was having babies, and still today I hear this all the time from mothers that are having babies, obstetrics and gynecology has a huge lawsuit rate. There are a lot of people suing their doctors. And, you know, you hear the same complaint all the time, especially from first-time mothers, that they spent 9 months going to a particular obstetrician, and they get to the hospital, and somebody they've never seen before comes in to deliver the baby, and they're obviously in stress and they're nervous wrecks, and they got some guy, it might be a woman, it might be a man, but again, who may be a resident, maybe somebody there on the weekend, the whole nine yards. And that seems so obvious too, that it seems, why don't obstetricians rotate? They'll have four obstetricians, you see different ones all during your pregnancy so that you don't have a total stranger showing up at the hospital. But they don't seem to catch on to that either. And that
no, you're right. And it's also the case, thing about this, your primary care person, if you really get sick, rarely do they come into the hospital to see you, even though you've built a relationship with them, and maybe they could be a bit of an advocate for you if you went in for, you know, a week or 2 weeks or something serious, but they often don't come in. The answer is efficiency. It's not economically efficient, and the bottom line is driving a lot of the healthcare delivery that you see, not what's necessarily best for the patient. I don't like to admit it, but it's true.
You know,
that's depressing, too, to think you wouldn't even see your primary care physician that you've been going to for 30 years.
And next week we'll go on to talk about the fact that we're all going to die.
Yes, we are.
We knew that.
Forward to it.
We didn't need a study for that either. Hey,
you know, we built a model that's very economically oriented, that is kind of got a professionalism being replaced by business ethics. You can see it shifting. I'll give you an example, just since I'm obviously in this segment trying to depress Marjorie. I asked my class, how many of you would come in if there was an epidemic, like a pandemic flu outbreak, or Ebola went crazy, or measles went nuts? How many of you medical students as a second year class would come in to volunteer and just help out? And only about 40% said they would. And years ago, I think you would have had a higher number. And when pushed, people tend to say, look, it's just a job. It's my business.
It's horrible.
Why should I put myself at risk? And, you know, that's a business ethic, not a medical ethic.
Wow. That is depressing. That's very depressing,
okay.
Art Kaplan.
I don't know if we're going to end with an upbeat story, but you wrote this piece that is surreal. I'm going to read the first paragraph, and then you can fill in the blanks. Art wrote this piece. A British high court has permitted Kyle Kason, a single man, to adopt an eight-month-old boy who was carried and delivered by a surrogate, Kason's own mother. Can you tell us the story? Marjorie, as she's reading this, is going, if I may, until she gets to a point you make later in the story. So tell us the story and the takeaway, too.
This was handled originally by maybe Johnny Cash, I think, did the country western song, I'm My Own Grandpa. Anybody remember that?
Oh, God.
No,
I think
but,
he was the first to go into this field. So the case, this is so good, it's like bioethics dream case. A man got permission to adopt what was basically his brother. How could that be? Because his mom acted as a surrogate mom for him. He got a donor egg and had it fertilized with his sperm, and it turns out that he's a single man and also a single gay man. So everything possible here, what you've got is his mom gives birth to his brother, who he wants to be the father, and the mom gives birth to her child, who she wants to be the grandmother to. Anybody still with me?
Yeah, we are.
Yes, we are.
And the conclusion of the ethicist is what?
So at first, I think people look at this and say, this is incest or worse or bad or something. I don't know that single men should do it, single gay men. I don't know about that. Well, there isn't any data that shows that gay men can't parent just fine. There isn't any data that shows that single gay men can't parent just fine any more than single heterosexual men. And there are lots of single people parenting. So I'm not saying they don't get troubles, but they don't get them at rates any more than, say, married parents do. No evidence there. And while it's all weird in terms of how the family got made, I think at the end of the day, if you think harder about it, it's just a different way to make a family. He's not going to treat the kid as his brother. He's going to treat this kid as his son. I think the grandma will be the grandma. I think it'll work.
Okay. And maybe I'm just, you know, old-fashioned. But the idea of mom's eggs and her son's sperm coming
together.
Not
mom's egg. Donor egg. She didn't give the egg.
Oh.
She just carried the baby.
Oh. Okay, I misunderstood. That makes
donor
me feel much better.
Me out too.
That makes
donor
me feel much better.
Me out.
Okay,
that
I misunderstood.
Me out
so you're better now or no?
I am much better
Can
now.
Can I make it feel even better? Another paragraph from Art's piece is, well, women have been using mothers and sisters as surrogates for some time, and no one has complained much about that. So it appears that the shocking nature of the beginning of the story gives way to the fact that this is not quite the norm, but it's not that aberrational, correct?
Right. There are plenty of women, let's say you were born without a uterus or you had to have it removed because it was cancerous or something, and they ask their sister or their mother to carry the baby. Again, Marjorie, not using their mom's egg.
Yeah, thank
they
you.
They may be able to use their egg or a donor egg from a stranger. But they need a uterus, and they, you know, enlist mom, and she does it. And I don't have a big problem with that.
No,
part of the reason
could,
you enlist mom, by the way, is cheaper.
You could lend your son the uterus, just as long as it wasn't your egg that was.
She's still not there. Trust me. So, what episode of House of Cards are you previewing in Everyday Ethics Podcast this week, Art?
No House of Cards. We're going to go right to this weird case we're talking about.
Oh, you are.
Yeah, too juicy, too good. It's got every reproductive technology angle and adoption, and should the court step in, and should you vet people who want to do this? Yeah, there's a lot there. But at the end of the day, I'm not going to reach any different conclusion than I did here, which is to say it's weird, but I think you could build families in this way.
All right, good
okay,
to talk to
Art
you.
Kaplan, thank you very much, and thank you for straightening me out on the donor egg situation. I was having a real difficult morning. Art Kaplan joins us every Wednesday. He is head of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU's Langone Medical Center. He is also the co-host of the Everyday Ethics Podcast. Thanks again, Art. And coming up, singer Ronan Tynan joins us for a preview of his upcoming performances at the Wilbur Theater. Ronan Tynan, the famous tenor, is next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.